This RFM podcast was brought to you with the support of New Zealand On Air.
Good morning. It is my last show of the year. Welcome, everybody, to my show, Everyday People, on 92.7 Arrow FM, your community access station. How exciting! How exciting is this? It's really exciting for me. I started the show at the end of January, did my first official proper show with a guest on the 7th of February, and here I am, still here. They can't get rid of me. I've locked myself in the studio. Yeah, taking over. No, I'm not. I'm just a little bit excited. It is Friday. No, it's not. Oh, my God. It is Wednesday, the 18th of December. How wrong could I get that? I've been thinking it's Friday all morning. I kind of wish it was. Then Scott's off on holiday. Yes, holidays. Not long now, Scott. Yes, look, it's just gone 9 a.m. here up at Arrow FM. And I am very excited to be bringing you the last show of the year. It's 13 degrees outside at the moment, but I'm not too sure if it's going to get much, much warmer, but we're not going to freeze, I can tell you that. Hopefully get a little bit more rain for those gardens. That's why I thought it was Friday. I've got my book on the wrong page and there's Friday written right in my face. I am very excited about this being my last show, of course. I've told you that numerous times. My interview today is with Noel McCarthy. We sat down and did this a few weeks ago, and I was just so buzzed, honestly, hyped as and buzzed to sit down with her and have this interview to share with you guys. And we talk about a lot of things, and I'll get onto that very, very soon. After that, I'm just going to talk about nothing in particular and play you some lovely songs that I've chosen for you guys today. I hope that you are having a fantastic day and are getting all ready for Christmas and spending time with your family and eating good food. Don't we just love that? I do. I'm on a bit of a roll at the moment making Christmas crack. Oh, I'm not making it ever again. I've made it twice. First time was amazing. Second time, not so much. Trying to make it sugar-free didn't really work, but I'm not doing that anymore. Hey, look, I'm going to stop talking. I'm going to put on this interview. Noel McCarthy, she is a Irish Kiwi award-winning writer. She's been in broadcasting for over 20 years. She's done amazing things in this country and worked for some really big names and also interviewed some really big names. And that is something and someone that I absolutely aspire to and am inspired by as well. So, without further ado, here we go. I'm so excited about this. This is my interview with Noel McCarthy. Oops, of course. Hi, everyone. I am sitting here with Noel McCarthy, which to me is a complete buzz. When I first met Noel, it was in a 12-step program meeting, and I was very taken with you. Hi, Noel.
Hi, Camille. What an honour to be here. Thank you so much for having me on Everyday People.
Oh, thank you so much. When we first met, I just thought you were just this woman, this Irish woman who was at a meeting that I was at, and then I'd see you now and then on the train, wouldn't I?
I need to tell all your listeners, because obviously you've changed career now, but yes. I need to tell all of your listeners what a wonderful transport professional you were.
Thank you.
Because you brightened up every single trip that I was having when I'd see your smiling face clicking my ticket.
Yes.
So it was a beautiful organic connection across.
It really was, actually.
Two different things. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And then recently I saw you, I went to the Patrick Gower gig, and I thought, I knew that woman. I know that woman. And then you spoke and I was like, I know that woman. And it's you. And I had no idea what you did.
I love that. And you were just so nice to me. Because you're nice to everyone.
Absolutely.
You're nice to all of the everyday people everywhere, every single day.
I try my best and I think that I'm doing quite well, in fact. Well, so people are probably going, so what does Noel do? Noel, you've done so very much. Look, I over-Googled you this morning. I've already told you this. You're an Irish Kiwi writer, which is fantastic. You're an award-winning writer. You're a broadcaster. You won the Ockman Award an island.
I'm going to get you to write my
CV. Yeah, I will. For me,
Camilla. The Ockhams were in New Zealand, actually. That was in New Zealand. Yeah, about 18 months ago, it was the award for best first book. And it was a real thrill and a buzz because some of my writing heroes have won those New Zealand book awards. So that was very exciting.
I couldn't even imagine the level of excitement to win something like that. But your book, Grand, Becoming My Mother's Daughter. Yes, she's holding the book up right now. Look, I read this book. I had to read this book. I had to know what it was about, who you were about, and how you got to where you are now. And gosh, does that book cover it. It's such a good read. And I cried and I laughed.
I never know what to say when people say I cried because I'm thrilled.
Yeah.
But I also have to say I'm very sorry for that experience. I hope that wasn't too hard for you, but thank you very much for telling me that.
It was amazing. There were so many things in the book that... I'm not a big user of this word, but it really resonated with me. That's not all that you've done. You've also done columns and reviews and first-person essays. I'm taking this straight from Google at the moment. But one thing that really intrigued me is your 20 years experience in broadcasting and how that came about, which is hilarious in the book, actually, how you moved to Auckland. You're working... in hospitality.
I was a waitress at Prego. Yes. Yeah, in Ponsonby Road. It's so wonderful being in here with you, Camille, in a real radio studio because I'm sitting here with my hands on Mr. Wilson's wonderful desk.
Yes.
And it is bringing me back. It is a muscle memory that is bringing me back to my time at 95 BFM.
Yes.
Auckland Radio, student radio. That was my first experience in radio. That was actually, and I think I say this in the book, but that was my first experience listening to the radio.
No way.
Was actually working in radio. Yeah. I mean, I grew up in an Irish house where the radio would be on in the background occasionally. But my dad was a big country and Western music listener. My mom didn't really listen to the radio. So it wasn't part of my sort of mental furniture. Mm. And then I came over here to New Zealand and I loved New Zealand as soon as I got here, you know. Why wouldn't you?
Exactly.
And I thought to myself after, I knew I had a year visa and I kind of had half a mind that I'd like to stay on if I could. But I thought if I do go back to Ireland, at the time I was signed up to do, I'm sort of taking you on a very circuitous route here, but bear with me, as she says. Yeah. I was signed up to do a master's in Gothic literature through the history department of the university where I got my BA.
Mm.
You know, obviously because I, that's a surefire pathway to a job and loads of money. And I thought to myself, gosh, I just had it in the back of my head that journalism was interesting. It was an interesting area, an interesting sector. And there was one master's that I'd heard about in Dublin that you could do, but I knew you needed experience. And I thought to myself, if I go back to Ireland, I'll need to have experience when I apply for this. So I was asking around in Auckland and a man who I was working with, who's ended up being a good friend, said to me, I'll go up to BFM. They take volunteers. So, you know, it was very much, I don't know what the setup is here, if it's the same, you know, I think so much of the history of radio and the might of radio is community radio and radio at that sort of grassroots level.
Absolutely.
Which was what BFM was. And the thing that I didn't know about BFM at the time, of course, was what an incubator it was for talent. Like Mikey Havoc was there. Jeremy Wells was there. Paul Casserly, who wrote and created Eating Media Lunch with Jeremy Wells. Yeah. You know, these people were just sort of wandering in and out of the place.
Yeah.
And so I went up and my first gig was as morning news writer. So we'd get the Herald and you'd have your blue pen and you'd write out stories. Attributing, I suppose.
Yeah.
You know, thanks very much to whoever for doing all the actual reporting on this. And that was my first experience of radio and it sort of went from there. But I don't know if you've had this moment, but you know what it's like when you put your headphones on, you put your cans on, you turn on that mic and you're on.
I love it. It takes me into a different world where I just feel amazing. It really does. I'm very passionate about doing this and very buzzed to be sitting here right now with you. Actually, I still keep thinking, like, this is actually so cool. I've read your book. I'm not going to go on and on, but it has been an amazing book to read, which you won the, and it's the international, you won, okay, International Institute of Modern Letters. You got to be their resident. Can you tell me what that was like?
Oh, that was an amazing experience. So that was last year. So this time 2 years ago, I got a phone call from Damien Wilkins, who is the head of the International Institute of Modern Letters in Wellington, Victoria University, Te Heringa Waka, saying, would you like to come and be our writer in residence? You can apply.
Yeah.
You know, I applied and I had a project in my head and I told them about the project and said I would like to be able to work on this.
Yeah.
So I got, when you're the writer in residence, you get an office with the most magnificent view out over the harbour in Wellington. Wow. And there's all these birds in the trees. And look, the truth is, it is quite intimidating in some ways because all you have to do is write.
Mm.
But that can be the hardest thing sometimes.
Yeah, exactly.
If you have, like, with my first book, I think it was easy in some ways, Camille, to tell myself I wasn't writing a book. I was just writing for the love of writing and the sake of writing. And it was during the pandemic that I wrote most of it. I had a little girl, you know, I had a four-year-old who was home from daycare. And the writing fitted into little spaces in life, you know, which meant that I didn't really overthink it. You know, it was just something that I was doing as much for my pleasure.
Yeah.
You know, there was a real sort of playfulness in it because I thought what had happened was I had these memories, you know, I had these memories from childhood and I was thinking, did that actually happen? Some of them had a particularly surreal quality to them. The whole book really started with a memory I had of my mother picking me up from school one day with a rabbit. She had this rabbit in a box that she and her best friend had bought for me, and the rabbit spent the rest of the taxi ride deeply, deeply unhappy to be in a box and to be in a taxi and to be held by my mother. And this this memory came to me at a time when my mom was very sick. You know, she was coming towards the end of her life. And I woke up one morning in New Zealand and I texted my brother and I said, do you remember the rabbit? And instantly he texted back, you know, he said it was a buck rabbit and it was really big. And that was the beginning. I didn't know I was writing a book about my relationship with my mother. You know, I'd certainly, if you'd asked me if that would be a book that I would write.
Yeah.
You know, I'd always wanted to be a writer, but I'd never thought about writing about that. But partly because it was such a fraught situation for me, you know, I spent a long time in my life deeply ashamed of not being able to have what I would consider a successful relationship with my mother, you know, a successful family life. And the idea that I would write about it, you know, was very surreal to me.
Yes. And I liked, and I think it was at the end of the book where you spoke about how, even though you and your siblings grew up in the same house, you all had your different memories of what happened, and these were specifically yours. And I really did think, I grew up in a family with five brothers and one sister, so I was sort of thinking that would be what would happen when you write a book. Everyone would have their own different memories.
And, absolutely.
Yeah, and all the different personalities as well.
And everyone had, I think I say it, like everyone had a different mother.
Yes.
You know, we all had different relationships. And it was funny, what inspired me to write that, Diana Wichtel, who was the longtime television critic for the New Zealand Listener, an amazing writer, I think one of the, you know, our finest writers here. She wrote an incredible book called Driving to Treblinka, which is about her father and his experience in the Holocaust and how that experience of trauma sort of resonated through her family. And she said, as part of this story, she talks just glancingly about the rest of her family, and she talks about this. She talks about how you can grow up in the same house as someone and have a completely different experience. And I guess I was very conscious, you know, as I wrote that note at the end of the book. That was the last thing I wrote. And at that point, I knew the book was going to be published. I knew it was going to come out. And it was horrible. I was just thinking, this is, you know, oh God, what's going to happen? And also, I wanted kind of intellectually to be honest. Like, I did not want people to think that I believe that this is the only version.
Because
that's the thing with a writer. Like, you get to write your version down.
Yes.
But that doesn't necessarily mean your version is the correct version. It's just the version that makes it to the record, if you know what I mean.
Yes.
And so I think in a way that note was kind of But I think it was me acknowledging that I didn't have the full story. You know, I had a story.
You had a story. Perception.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So I absolutely love how... So I am in recovery myself. Mm. You are in recovery. That is how we met, and how it absolutely changes you and you start seeing things so differently. I think you spoke about when you're on a bus or in a taxi and you just started looking and seeing things differently.
Oh, yeah.
When you were at a point before that where you didn't look.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, and that was another, like that part of the book where I was on the bus, Richmond Road.
Yes.
Richmond Road in Auckland. Because I didn't drive until I moved down here to the Wairarapa, right? I moved to Featherston and I had to drive every single day, as we do, you know, when we're in the country. But that's why I met you on the train, because I was always a pedestrian or a public transport taker.
Yeah.
And so in Auckland, which was where I stopped drinking, you know, that's my story. It happened in Tamaki. I would get the bus every day. You know, because I would get the bus everywhere or walk, and I used to get the bus to meetings during the day.
Yeah.
And on this particular bus ride, you know, there's something meditative about busing, like about being on the bus, because you don't have to do it.
No.
The train is the same. You don't have to do anything. You're looking out the window. And that was a moment for me when I look back on it, because, you know, time had passed since then when I sat down to write, when I was writing about it. I thought that's where it happened. Like, it literally happened going past the countdown on Richmond Road. And I remember that journey, and I remember my feelings changing, because I think that was the first time that I stopped being afraid of growing up.
Yeah.
You know, I was at the tender age of 30 odd, whatever. I think I was 30, because I was 30 when I got sober. But that was the first time that I actually felt a bit of a release from that fear.
Yeah.
You know, that terrible fear of everybody else has gotten the memo about what it's like to be an adult and to go to bed at a reasonable hour and buy some furniture or whatever it is, you know, adult looks like to you. And that was that moment for me.
Yeah. I absolutely love that. And just reading that, it's my recovery has brought me back into the studio where I want to listen to people and I want to know people and hear their story, because everyone has such a fascinating story. And the fact that you are able to write your story in the way that you have as well, like I would stop and Google words or Google places to look. So, and when you're to talk about your family gatherings, like at pubs and stuff like that, I could see it in my head. And I just think, well done for that. It was just amazing.
You so much. I have a friend who looked up all the bus routes in Cork after he read it. He just wanted to know.
Yeah.
He's really into public transport also. And he just wanted to know where everything was in relation. And it was funny as well, because I realised one of the things you realise when you're writing this sort of stuff, like first person stuff, is your own spatial awareness. Like how does everything sit inside your head?
You know,
and I think trains and buses and planes, you know, because there's a lot of planes in that story.
Oh, there's a lot of plane trips, yes.
Yeah, and it is the story. I mean, for me, it's as much a story of life in New Zealand as life in Ireland. And the and of course, you know, the end of the story in the book is me in the Wairarapa.
Yeah.
You know, and that's where this book was written. Like, this book is, it wouldn't have been possible if we hadn't moved to Featherston. Like, we wouldn't be able to sort of, my husband and I, we are writers and we make podcasts.
Yeah.
And a big part of what's made that possible is living outside a city, you know, being able to sort of, we work from home. All of those things are possible because we're here. So you that's great.
You find peace.
Yeah, I think you do. Yeah. I mean, peace is optimistic. But on a good day, I mean, on a good day, absolutely you do. And I think the other thing that happened for me, the experience of growing up, you know, which wasn't, and it didn't happen until I was in my 30s.
Yeah.
But it's also just even wanting peace, even aspiring towards peace.
Yes.
Was an evolution for
me. Yes. It's something I aspire to a lot, and I do find it a lot these days with the life that I live. So now that you are quite settled in the Wairarapa, you are giving your daughter an almost opposite of what you grew up with, and that is something that you wanted in a sense, isn't it?
It's so interesting, isn't it? Because geographically, pretty much,
yes,
you know, we're on the other side of the world. And the interesting thing, I guess, is the ways in which her upbringing, in so many ways, it's different to mine. You know, she goes to a small school in a small town and all of those things. But Camille, there's so many similarities as well. You know, one of the things that writing Gran taught me, and this was quite humbling, was how wrong I was about so much. You know, seeing the ways in which my parents loved me and valued me and gave me, you know, like gave me strength, but gave me a story, gave me all of those different things.
Absolutely.
And one thing, you know, the book starts with me remembering stories that my mother loved. You know, it was always fairy tales because they're very dark. But Eve, my daughter, loves fairy tales. Mm. You know, we share those things. I went to the Panto in Wellington with her, which I heartily recommend.
Yes.
It's Sleeping Beauty this year. And it's a fantastic. Sleeping Beauty does. And nobody told me there's bangers in it. Like Sleeping Beauty does a version of Halo, which will just make you cry.
Oh, wow.
Yes. And there's Chapel Rowan in there, Charlie XCX. It's brilliant.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. It's excellent. But what I noticed was how similar that experience was to experiences I had with my mother. You know, she insisted on stories and she insisted on a kind of magic, you know, which that I see those continuities, but at the same time wanting to try to break particular cycles.
Absolutely.
You know, we had like, you know, I think the interesting thing about writing Grand was when people, especially women, come up and talk to me about it afterwards, you know, they don't talk to me about my life. They talk to me about their lives.
Yeah.
They talk to me about their mothers, their grandmothers, their grandfathers sometimes, their uncles. You know, these lines of intergenerational trauma and experience, all of which is heavy stuff. And in the book, you know, like, because that's what I grew up with as well.
Yeah.
And what I loved about it was that that's been a common experience.
Yeah.
You know, because I didn't know that when I was writing. I was like, oh, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, like especially when I would go to meetings, and when I was in rehab as well, I was very much confronted with the fact that I'm not the only one.
Which
it's not all about me.
Yeah.
Like, oh, far out. Someone else has experienced that. No way. And then I'd feel very sad for them because the realization that someone else had experienced that hit me as well.
That for me was a glimmer of a sort of a first little sense of a lack of self-obsession, you know, which it took a while to break through, but I really thought that you know, I had all the weight of the world on me. I was all of those things felt very personal to me towards the end of drinking for me.
Yeah.
You know, that was how it was. And one of the great things about a sort of a shared experience of recovery is, you know, because you hear, as you say, you hear all the time that we're never alone. And those experiences are shared experiences. And if you wanted a trauma Olympics, I would be nowhere near the medals, right? Like I'd be not getting up on the podium.
No.
So, you know, that is you're right. Like, that is a really great realization.
It is a great realization. I think some of us need them more. I really want to touch on how you are a huge fan of Dracula, Bram Stoker.
And you texted me on his birthday, Camille, which was the most thoughtful thing. Thank you so much.
As soon as I saw it, I was like, I wonder if she knows. I have to text her. So I'm really glad that I did. So I know that, if I've got it wrong, please, I'm sure you'll tell me. Are you trying to, or are you writing at the moment? Please tell me.
Yeah.
You can say it better than me.
You know, that's the joke when you say to someone, I'm writing a book, and the other person says, me neither.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
I am trying. I am writing a book about my experience with Dracula. You know, my experience of reading that book, because I think, again, I think it's a common experience that you read something at a certain age and it gets under your skin.
Oh, yeah.
And sometimes that is a lifelong relationship, a lifelong obsession.
Yes.
And it certainly was for me. And, you know, I talk about it in Grand. I read Dracula for the first time when I was 14. And it sort of stayed with me through my life in different ways. And this is what this book is about. It's a sort of an exploration of that, you know, the ways for good and for ill, and the ways in which it shaped me as a woman and as a writer. Like a lot of my work, I think, has been informed by that in one way or another. Dracula is a novel that was written by Bram Stoker, our friend whose birthday was a couple of weeks ago.
Yes.
A Scorpio.
Yes.
I think.
I don't know.
But I think a Scorpio. It's a novel that, okay, it's a few things about Dracula. It was published in 1897, so not that long ago.
No, not long.
In living memory. And it's a horror novel about a monster, as we know. He's got the long teeth. But one thing about Dracula that is interesting is it's a novel made up of diary entries and fragments from newspapers and people's sort of reports at the end of the night. One of the characters is a doctor. And so what you have really is this sort of grab bag of journalism in the book, and it's telling this fantastical story of this ancient monster from Transylvania who comes bang into the middle of 19th century London with the trains and the typewriters and the blood transfusions and the Kodak cameras, and he's right in there, this ancient terrible monster who'll bite you, but it feels good.
Yeah.
You know, so there's a lot going on there. There's a lot. And then, I mean, the story for Bram Stoker wasn't great in the sense that he was very busy. He ran a theatre in London and he wrote a lot of books. And Dracula was kind of the only one that had any success, and it didn't have any success in his lifetime. He died poor. He died of exhaustion. That was on his cert, I think, his death cert. And he died of a kidney failure.
Wow.
And he died kind of sick and tired. And it was only really in the 1920s and 1930s when a bunch of successive filmmakers got hold. There was a very famous play version of it. And then the filmmakers got hold of Dracula. And that's when that intellectual property sort of took off.
Yeah.
And he had a wife called Florence, who was from Dublin. And she was a real terrier about his intellectual property. And she really fought, you know, for him to be acknowledged and for money for the adaptations. But, you know, Stoker never had any idea of what would happen, you know, of the place the vampire would take in the culture. And, you know, I grew up in the 90s.
Yeah.
You know, Francis Ford Coppola, Bram Stoker's Dracula, Keanu Reeves, Gary Oldman, Mina Harker played by Winona Ryder. My God.
Yeah.
You know, it was a perfect storm. And it wasn't just that. It was The Lost Boys. It was few years later, Buffy the Vampire Slayer. You know, these vampires that have sort of threaded their way through the culture. So when it's been really fun.
Yeah.
Like going back and looking at all of this and saying, okay, what was the influence of that? Stoker was Irish, of course. That's the thing.
He
was
up
until the age of 30. He was a civil servant in Dublin and he ran away to London to run a theatre. So everything about it and him, the more I look at it, the more interesting it gets to me. And
it's very interesting.
Yeah, it's a story about creativity. It's a story about work. It's a story about class. It's a story about sex. It's a story about addiction. You know, the vampire needs to drink. he has to drink.
Absolutely. I never thought of it that way.
Yeah. So there's all of these. It's a story about land. He has to have dirt in his coffin.
Yeah.
And it has to be dirt from his homeland. And you know, for a country like Ireland with our own colonial history, that's really significant. It's a story about what you might call like imperial anxieties. You have England at the time in the 19th century, the greatest empire in the world, but you've got this creature coming from the east into the heart of the west just to cause havoc.
Yeah.
So all of these things.
Yeah.
I mean, it's huge and kind of also it's camp. You know, Dracula is sort of silly. You know, you can have Dracula in a theatre and the little sort of phone emojis. There's all sorts of things. So I didn't necessarily intend to write another memoir. You know, like, I didn't intend to write the first memoir.
Yeah.
But this was always, when I was at university, this is what I wanted to write about. This is what I was interested in.
Yeah.
And I gave all that up to come to New Zealand.
Yes.
So, you know, in a way it feels like a return to this, but not the way I originally intended it. You know, the way I write about it isn't academic. It's not. And that was intimidating at the start. You know, there's been a lot of really clever scholarship about this stuff, but this isn't that. This is not that.
I'm really looking forward to reading that.
Oh, thank you. I'm really looking forward to finishing that.
Yes.
I'm nearly there.
I actually bet you are. I actually watched a new horror last night called Abigail, and it was to do with vampires. Ooh. It was really good.
They just keep going, don't they? They keep multiplying.
Absolutely. I think that's actually amazing. How are the driving lessons going?
See, Camille knows. I had one before. They're fantastic, you know. And I mean, driving's really interesting, isn't it? In terms of growing up, that was the last thing that I needed to do. And yeah. I got my restricted license when I came to the Wairarapa first. So that's 6 years ago now, yeah. Christmas. And it's time. It's time to do the next step, because that means I can actually rent cars and help my husband when we're going doing interviews around the Motu. You know, I can actually do that. So, but it's scary. I mean, because you have such a responsibility on the road.
Oh, absolutely. And especially when you've got precious cargo, like your daughter in the car as well.
Yes.
I think it would be quite exciting for you to drive around Ireland as well.
Me too. I can't imagine.
The scenery. I mean, New Zealand's got beautiful scenery, but your homeland has got amazing scenery as well.
They're very similar in lots of ways.
So beautiful, you know, green.
There's a lot of green and a lot of sheep.
Absolutely. So what is it that you and your husband do?
We make podcasts.
Yes.
So we have a podcast company called Bird of Paradise. What happened was in 2016, I was asked to make the first podcast that Radio New Zealand, RNZ, were going to make, because it was, you know, podcasts were starting. And I made a podcast about aging called A Wrinkle in Time. and one of the things I did, because I'd never made a podcast before, I rang up the guys who ran a sort of famous American podcast called Radio Lab.
Yeah.
And they said to me, we usually do 18 drafts of every script, and there's usually a big team of us working on it. And I said, well, if you were the only person, hypothetically speaking, if you could only have one other person on your team, what would that role be? And they said, you've got to have a script editor. You've got to have someone looking after the writing of your podcast. And had a husband who's also a writer who, you know, was in earshot and arm's length. So that's kind of how we started writing together. And then in 2017, we started a company. And so now we do, we tell long form stories.
Yeah.
So you know how it is, like audio is so immersive anyway, you can get right into it. And what you can do is tell a story over 6-8 episodes, whatever.
Yeah.
You know, you can tell an episodic story.
Yes.
And you can have characters and you can have plot and you can have all of those things. Except in our case, usually up until now, we've always been telling nonfiction stories. Mm. So they really happened.
Yeah.
You know, this is people's lives and the incredibly dramatic things. Mm. You know, the first project I did with a company, my friend Emma had been accepted into medical school. And Emma is Ngāti Te Kōrehe, an iwi down in Ōtaki, near Ōtaki and Ngāti Porou on her nanny's side. So we looked at her experience of coming into a health system, which by every metric isn't working for Māori.
Yeah.
It's not delivering for Māori in the same way that it's delivering for Pākehā and New Zealanders.
Yes.
And kind of experiencing institutional racism at all those different levels and investigating that, also talking to the incredible kaupapa Māori providers who are just doing amazing work all over New Zealand, all over Aotearoa. And that was a podcast called Getting Better. A Year in the Life of a Māori Medical Student. That was the first one. And I loved that. You know, it was such a great experience, because it was my first time even having anything to do journalistically with Te Ao Māori. Yeah. So I had a lot to learn.
Yeah.
And still learning, you know, but that was amazing. And then John and I have continued working together. So we're collaborating together at the moment on a new series for the New Zealand Herald, which is about the Mr. Asia drug syndicate.
Oh.
Mm. Mm. So in the 1970s, there was a period of time where arguably the most successful drug syndicate in the world was from New Zealand.
Yes.
And they were heroin importers, and they were doing it across New Zealand, Australia, the UK. They were trying to get into America. And it all came crashing down at a certain point in the late 70s because of a murder, of the discovery of a murdered member of the syndicate in a place called Chorley in England. So I went to Chorley last year And I was at home in Ireland and then over there. And that's kind of where the story starts.
Yeah.
The story starts, it'll come out in February. And the story starts with the discovery of this member of the syndicate in a quarry in Chorley.
But I'm getting excited.
Yeah, it is, it's wonderful work. I mean, I know what you say about audio, you know, like there is something about this medium that is so immediate.
Yes.
And so immersive.
Yeah.
And being able to be creative with it, to cut it up and play with it and edit it and
absolutely,
you know, work with amazing sound engineers and composers is just the next level for creativity. I love that.
Absolutely. Oh my goodness, I feel inspired actually.
Thank you.
Very much so. Well, I think we've coming to the end now. I'm just absolutely still buzzing. Is there any advice you would give to, it doesn't have to be for a young person. I turned 50 this year and I'm still just learning all the time. What advice would you give to somebody who wants to write? And I know we can just write, but it's not that easy. What's something that you would suggest to someone? Or
I think it's a habit. You know, I think it's getting that practice, you know, that daily, because, you know, it is what you do, you are.
Mm.
And I think so many of us, everyone has a story.
Mm.
You can back yourself in that. You don't have to second guess that.
Yeah.
But it is the habit. You know, badly written is better than not written.
Yes.
So having that habit, for me, it was, I took 20 minutes, you know, it was 20 minutes. I might have started with 10, but it's taking that time every day and writing. And what you will find over time is that your writing will build up, right?
Mm.
You will have a bunch of words and then you can look at editing them or what you do with them next. Maybe they're the start of a different kind of project. Maybe you've written something that you want to paint with. But, you know, it's having that, I think it's that daily practice of writing. And then the other thing that I do is I try to get past that critic in my head.
Yeah.
You know, because we all have it up here, don't we?
I mean,
I know we do, but I think everybody does, you know. And for me, you know, lately it's been a bit insane. You know, I've been getting up earlier and earlier just because the earlier I start, the more playfulness I can bring into it. And the more it feels like I'm eluding whatever adult is in there saying, this is rubbish. This is no
good.
So I think that's a very real thing. I think we have an idea of a writer in our heads, but a writer is just someone who writes.
Yeah.
You know? So it's having that, it's having the daily practice, but also telling the critic to shut up.
Yes, shut up.
You're not invited.
Yeah.
Please leave.
Yes. Oh, thank you so much, Noelle McCarthy, joining me on Everyday People here at RFM 92.7. Thank you so much.
It's been my absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for having me, Camille.
Thank you. Oh, how amazing was that? Oh, that was Noelle McCarthy. She sat down with me a few weeks ago here at Arrow FM and we had that chat. And what a fantastic chat. That was really, really, I'm just really happy about that. I don't need to say words twice to let you guys know how cool that was. You're listening to Camille on her show, Arrow. You're listening to Camille on her show, Everyday People, here at Arrow FM 92.7, your community access station, where we have amazing program makers and amazing content like you just listened to and saw just then. Noelle McCarthy, thank you so much for being such a star for me that day and just talking. It was so good. Look, I'm going to play a song now. And you know what, guys? You're tuned into the last show for the year and it's been an amazing year. So let's play Maybe Tomorrow by Golden Horse.
Nothing to hold us.
maybe tomorrow with Golden Horse. Maybe. Maybe tomorrow. Hey, what did you take from that chat with Noel McCarthy? I wrote down a couple of things that I took from it. And I've just folded my page over, haven't I? But my favourite thing was badly written is better than not written. And, oh, Camille, you've got to get off your ass and get a book written, that's for sure. And if it's not a big, big book, it's going to be a book of short stories, I think, because that's how my brain works. And it was Scott that suggested that, because he's fantastic, and he knows me better than anyone, I'd damn well say. Hey, I'm going to do roll call. Roll call here at 92.7 RFM, your community access station, on Camille's show, Everyday People. I want to call out everyone who's been on my show, and this is a big thank you to Blair, Udom, Shan, Kate, Tungiwai, Michael, James, Coral, and Nikki from Jeff and the Angry Stick, Wayne, Davi, Nahina, and Amos, Paulie, Josh, Victoria, Alton, and Jansen, Alton again, Jordan, Jordan, Jaysa, Stephanie, Matthew, Paulie, Toby, Jenna, Karen, Courtney, Piers, Kate again, Marina, Alton again, and Mike King, Darren Knight and Uncle Dirty Mike. Darren Knight and Uncle Dirty Mike and Lucy, who was sitting in the corner hiding. Then it was me by myself, Nicole and Jason, Nick and Oscar, Anthony and Joe, Thomas Oliver, Alton Halford this time, Aaron Slight, and Noel McCarthy. What a roll call that is. You guys absolutely made my year, and you made every week so, so special. There were a couple of weeks I couldn't make it, but who cares? Shut up, Camille. You're thanking these amazing people, and guess what? Drum roll. I can't do a drum roll that light. It sounds like finger guns. I'm going to finger gun you. Next year, I have an amazing lineup as well, and I'm not reading those names out yet because exciting. But next year I am back on the 8th of January to start this all over again, and I am bringing in another local legend who is not just fantastic at music, drums, and a pretty, pretty big name band that he plays for, but he's also into physical fitness and does a lot of swimming. There's some hints for you guys. I know some of you guys have probably already worked that out, but I'm really looking forward to having him in the studio on the 8th of January. And then I've just got a whole another lineup. It's going to be a little bit different next year. I am getting a new knee, so I may have some time off, but we will work something out, won't we, guys? Because I'm going to miss you and you'll miss me, but please take so much care over this holiday period and look out for each other and just love each other. What is the thing that everyone's saying at the moment? We listen and we don't judge, because honestly, stick your judginess where the sun does not shine. I'm so not into that anymore. And eat the food and do the things and just let them. And you know what I mean? Just let them. You guys have been absolutely awesome. Oh, that's a bit sad saying goodbye, but I will see you again very, very soon. Once again, thank you so much for tuning in to Camille on her show, Everyday People, here at 92.7 Arrow FM, your community access station. Ta-ta.